So in June 2020, just a few weeks into lockdown, Danny Kruger, a Tory MP, was asked by the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, to work with Civil Society's Minister, Diana Baron, to put forward some proposals to maximise the role of charities in, as they described, the next phase of the COVID-19 recovery. Johnson asked Kruger to develop proposals to maximise the role of volunteers and community groups and faith groups, charities and social enterprise, and to contribute actively to what he called the government's levelling up agenda. A really interesting phrase. In a moment, we're going to be discussing the Kruger review with the man who wrote it, with Danny Kruger. This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Keith Davis.
And I'm Camilla McGibbon.
Just give us a snapshot, Keith. How important do you think this is?
Oh, I think it underlines everything that the charity sector needs going forward for the future, especially because of where we're facing all the challenges with the virus at the moment. So I think most charities will look forward to working with it.
We'll get into some detail in a minute. Camilla, your initial reaction?
I think it could be very important if it can deliver. I think that communities build trust on two things. One, do they know and like you? And two, do you deliver whatever it is you promise? The huge issue for government is how is this going to sustain?
Well, look, we've all read the report. It's about 50-odd pages long. It didn't feel to me like a huge, substantial piece of work, but some quite interesting ideas. What were some of your highlights that you've picked out?
The levelling up challenge, I think, is, whilst recognised, I don't think it's as easy as maybe this paper suggests to solve. And I think there's got to have a lot of work to do with that between the North East and the Midlands. You know, I think they're looking at where they're going to get some philanthropy, some money coming in. I'm not convinced that will come in the same way unless they've already got a handshake on it at this stage. But it's going to take money.
Yeah.
The thing that hangs over this a little bit, Camilla, is a similar-ish pronouncement 10 years ago with David Cameron and the idea of the big society. There are quite a lot of crossovers, although the author, Danny Kruger, is at pains to put himself at distance from the idea of the big society, which is quite interesting.
Yes, the Localism Act came out of all of that. And having had some experience of one specific arena, which is neighbourhood plans, These were very much ideas, again, like Danny is espousing, let's put power into the hands of communities. And the neighbourhood plan took, in my experience locally, 8 years just to get to a point where it might possibly be voted on by local people. So when he is going into something similar, which is community bids, business improvement district, community improvement district, the complexity of the organisation behind that is vast.
Alex Scales from the Centre for Charity Effectiveness is also with us. And Alex, you've been looking at the reaction to the report from the charity sector in the first few days, as we are, since its publication. What's your sense of how it's gone down?
Overall, I think it's been well received, been described as comprehensive, ambitious. I think there's some thinking around the document is more of a compilation, perhaps, rather than, you know, reflecting the freshest thinking. I think we have to remember that it is a set of proposals at this stage, which, you know, the Prime Minister has promised in writing to consider in due course, which puts a question mark over the timing aspect. And I think what's coming through from the sector really is, you know, what are the hooks that are really going to engage government and also Treasury to get some real action?
It's difficult to see a sense really in how they want to reboot the relationship, isn't it? There's no acknowledgement, for example, as we've heard from a past guest on this podcast, that charities have felt frozen out by this government. There's no sense of rebooting the relationship, is there?
In terms of elevating the position of charities and social enterprises, there's nothing proposed on that. And hence, I guess I go back to my point, what's the hook in the report that is going to engage government and equally Treasury? And I guess it goes back to this measurement of social value contribution to the overall wider economy.
It's going to be very interesting to hear what he's got to say. Up next on Good Charity, Bad Charity, it's Danny Kruger, the author of this new review into the role of charities in society today. So who is Danny Kruger, MP, and why has he been asked to write this report about the future of the charity sector? Well, Danny Kruger's been an MP, a Conservative MP for Devizes in Wiltshire, since the December 2019 election, all of 10 months. Before that, he served as Boris Johnson's political secretary from August 2019. His background is in the charity sector, think tanks and journalism. He was previously a chief leader writer at The Telegraph. In 2006, Danny and his wife Emma, a former teacher, founded the youth crime prevention charity Only Connect. And in 2017, he received the MBE for services to the charity sector. Danny Kruger joins us now. I just want to quote a little bit from the top of the report. You talk about communities who've experienced the failure of successive governments to adequately support the deindustrialisation of the British economy. Forgive me, Danny Kruger, it reads a little bit like a report that's written to appeal to One Nation Conservatives who are perhaps feeling a bit guilty about Margaret Thatcher's decimation of the industrial regions of Britain in the 1980s.
Well, I'll be blunt about my view on this. I think Margaret Thatcher's revolution was a good one and privatisation was a good thing. The economy was restructuring itself and it was right that government supported that. What we as a party and government did in those years, and I'm afraid Blair and Brown subsequently, no government has successfully helped the deindustrialised towns to adjust. There was an economic doctrine which prevailed at the time which said that with a bit of help, labour, now unemployed, will move to the places of high employment, to the big cities and particularly to the south, and that the job of government was to enable that with house building and transport infrastructure and so on. But not everybody did, and not everybody wants to. And I, in my report, and what I think is that we should honour the decision of people to stay where they are, to invest their lives in the places they grow up. And government policy shouldn't be all about helping people get out.
OK, well, we want to take you through some of those ideas that you've put forward in the review, starting with the social covenant with communities. Camilla, I think you've got a question on this.
Yeah. One of your key proposals in the report is the Community Power Act, which affirms the right of ordinary people to effect meaningful change in their own neighbourhoods. Now, I've been involved in communities for 25 years. How is that going to work?
Let me start with a bit of a prevarication, but I hope you'll agree with, which is that it's not appropriate for me as a single MP or even for the government itself to say, right, well, because remember, this report was inspired by the experience of the lockdown when everybody came together. It's not right for us to simply say, right, well done, everybody. Now we're going to organise you in the following way and you're going to do we're going to do this, this and that. We need to develop these policies collaboratively. So what I've set out here, it's not a very long report, it's headline principles. I think we need a declaratory act of parliament which says every public servant and every public service and every tier of government has a responsibility proactively to think, how can we hand power and responsibility away? How can we give communities a greater say and a greater role in the management of their common life together? That is not to say government should be getting out of the way altogether. I'm a firm believer in the roles of central and local government. But we know that we have an over-bureaucratised system where, frankly, public servants paid by the taxpayer sitting in government offices are able to disregard the interests and the wishes of local people. And we need to challenge that and say your absolute job is to give power away.
Do you think there is a will, Danny, in communities to go through the necessary processes of acts and restructuring, etc., etc., in order to get to the place that they might already feel they're at with COVID? In other words, one-to-one helping of their neighbours.
Very good question. So we must make some important distinctions. You know, I was speaking on the radio to my local Wiltshire radio this morning, and they had some volunteers saying exactly that. Why do we need government? We're doing it ourselves. And this was also always the argument against the big society. What's David Cameron talking to us about our communities for? We're doing it. So at that level, in terms of the very face-to-face work that we all can do locally, I don't think government needs to be mobilising or doing very much at all. But I'm talking about a level up where big decisions are made and services are run. We currently have too many barriers to people getting involved and exercising power. And the culture is discouraging of it as well. It's not actually that hard to set up a campaign or even a community interest company or charity and to try and get some work and to work with government. But the general culture is that isn't what people do, you know, but that's what government does. And I think it's the responsibility on the system, on the state, to very proactively say, we want to engage more, we want to open up.
Okay, moving on to another subject which runs through the report, which is about data collection around what charities are doing and also tech application. Keith?
Yeah, thank you for that. Touching on the last bit, I think you do need to be, we need to build on this whole I can do attitude to make sure some of this is delivered in local areas. But you talk about the relationship between government and charities, and it's been held back because of the lack of data. What type of data are you sort of looking for, and where do you think this data is going to come from?
Well, there's two forms of data that are, at the moment, both inadequate and they don't talk to each other. One is government data and the other is civil society data. So we don't know what government does. We don't know what its outcomes are. We don't know the billions of pounds that are spent through the third sector and all its guises. Where's that going geographically, sector-wise? What are its outcomes? What are the value for money calculations? I mean, all of that is being addressed, but it couldn't happen sooner. And then the other one is civil society data. If we properly insisted that any public money, within reason and proportionately, because you don't want to make small charities do loads of data collection and so on.
Exactly.
But within reason, big contracts should and grants should come with a requirement to produce data to a common standard. That's the crucial thing. I'm a big believer in the 360 giving data standard. Not because I really understand data, but just because that's now a well-established standard that lots of public and charitable sector organisations are using. I think we should just compel government and its large suppliers in the charity sector to produce data to that standard. And then suddenly, you know, the light comes on. You know, we can suddenly see stuff that we couldn't see before.
I totally accept that. I think, though, what you're asking for, and I assume you're committed to it, that to get charities to deliver that piece of work as well is going to require an element within any grant to support a corporate core to do that.
Yes, I mean, that has to be worked out. But this stuff shouldn't be as expensive and difficult as it is. We all need to become more data literate, and a lot of the responsibility is on charities. And I think we should be harnessing volunteers and trustees and businesses to be supporting charities to become more data literate. At the moment, you know, we are the worst sector in the economy for data and skills. So we need to get better. When I say we, speaking of myself as charity founder. But yes, any costs need to be factored into the contract.
Right.
You seem to be very keen, Danny, on libraries, almost bordering on the obsessional. You know, they get referenced quite a lot in the review. You also link the possibility that tech firms, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, Microsoft, might in some way get involved in creating tech hubs at libraries, slightly worryingly, potentially, in return for a tax settlement. I don't know. What's the big deal about libraries? Why not sports clubs, youth clubs, pubs, village shops?
Well spotted, David. I am rather obsessed with libraries. What I like about them is they're both very old and very modern. They are the repository of the wisdom of a community, or they should be. And historically, they were the window through which bright, poor kids could develop knowledge of the world, and they were for adult education, and they were the engines of social mobility in a place. The future for the libraries is incredibly bright, you know, but it does require them to become digital centres. And I do think there's a role for big tech in this. I mean, I know some people are worried about letting them have anything to do with our society or our social infrastructure. I think as long as we insist they're not getting any commercial benefit or any access to our data, then we should be harnessing their enormous skills and assets and wealth to create the digital infrastructure our communities need. So I think there is a role. And, you know, they're not, they might be evil in lots of ways, but you know, they're also the ways, as we know, as we've seen through the lockdown, of how communities organise themselves. So I don't think we can think of social infrastructure without Facebook and WhatsApp and others. It's part of the mix.
It feels a slightly unholy alliance, though. You know, these big American tech giants getting involved in very British institution of libraries, and with that sort of cloud of data flying around and people's concern around data, it might be a little bit ambitious.
Well, this is where we need a conversation, and I'm no tech expert. I just think they exist. They need to make amends for all of the evils that they do to us, and they have skills and money. And it might just be that we just, you know, we get the cash off them and invest in these institutions and have, you know, British non-profits, which, as it were, do the work. As I said, there's no proprietary software involved here. There's no data capture. There's no commercial opportunity. And yes, in a sense, it is, should be a part of their settlement for taxation. I don't think the best thing to do with any business in terms of its social contribution is to just tax it and then give the money to others. So businesses can just do what they like as long as they pay their taxes. We want companies to have social responsibility, and I think that applies to the big tech as well. We want them to be directly supporting communities, not just via the tax man.
But if you go back in history, actually the Carnegie libraries were almost exactly what you're saying about potentially the Google libraries.
Well put, and exactly. So you had the companies that made the railroads, you know, the infrastructure of their day, investing in places. Thank you, Camilla, I'm going to use that.
Clearly, in order to have this infrastructure there, you need volunteers and you need a way of marshalling them. And there's a very ambitious suggestion, which sounds a bit like a new national service. Camilla, I know you've got thoughts on the volunteer passport system.
Yeah, in the report, you call it a non-proprietary system, held in trust for the public, not provided by a commercial operator, where people are invited to join a national volunteer reserve. So, Danny, how is this not national service?
Well, because you're not signing up to join the army, you're signing up to a volunteer reserve. But it has some of the same flavour. It's about service to the nation. The idea is to enhance and somewhat to formalise or to make permanent what we've seen happen in the lockdown, which was many hundreds of thousands of people signed up to be volunteers through the NHS Responder programme, which has been somewhat attacked and with some justification, but it was very successful in its reach, and it sort of half worked, and I think we should build on it. This comes under my heading of the volunteer passport. I think we do need, not at the most local level, you know, helping out in villages like I was describing, but anything that requires ongoing management and regulation, you know, that requires a DBS check, where public money is involved, or where there are real civic duties being fulfilled, I think it's appropriate for that to be, to a certain extent, managed together. And what we actually could have is a really effective system of matching supply and demand for voluntary effort. Because although we all should be very proud of ourselves in this country for the amount of volunteering that happens, particularly recently, there are huge gaps, particularly at the more formal end of volunteering, from charity trustees and school governors, magistrates, special constables, also, you know, less formal but very responsible positions like scout leaders. We actually don't have enough, you know, there are vacancies in all of these. So I think by enabling a system where people can find opportunities and where people can properly move between different voluntary roles, I think we'll get a lot more out of society.
Would you pay them?
No. Although I have a related suggestion around young people who are going to be facing an unemployment spike in the months to come, which sadly, probably, which is that I think we could be using the Kickstart program, which is about funding young people into employment. And mostly it's aimed, I hope, to be in the private sector. But I think we could use that scheme to support social sector to fund young people to deliver kind of social action work, which might be otherwise called volunteering, but we would subsidise those young people to do that work. But no, in general, I'm not proposing using the volunteer passport as a payment system. Some roles have a stipend attached, but most don't.
Alex, the role of social enterprises.
Yeah, we were really pleased to see such recognition of the role of social enterprises in the report, particularly in terms of increasing jobs and enhancing employment within communities. I guess my concern is so many of those organisations, which include many, many charities who rely on trading to deliver social value through enterprise, many of these are going to have been hit so hard by the time we emerge out of COVID that they will have pared down such that they can't then rebuild fast enough to be able to provide this solution to generate more employment within their local economies. What would you like to see the government doing more of now to enable these social enterprise organisations to survive over the next 6 to 12 months such that they're really well placed to drive things forward post-COVID?
Great point. And often we talk in these conversations as if charities are the only organisation, whereas actually social enterprise is the sort of growth area. And you're right that the social enterprises have been very badly hit. I mean, these are organisations which did the right thing, got out of grant dependency and got into commercial trading. And those are the ones that have been clobbered the worst, naturally, by what's happened in retail. I think the answer is a quite straightforward one, and it does involve government money, I'm afraid. And it's the idea that the School for Social Entrepreneurs have developed called Trade Back. And it's basically a match funding scheme for trading done by social enterprises to get back to pre-COVID levels. So any trading that they do until they get back to recovery, the government should support that.
Keith, I think you've got a question about funding.
Yeah, I've got a big question about funding. Obviously, there's a lot of issues within the 20 areas you want to try and address, and it's about how we're going to get that funding. You talked about philanthropy and you talked about encouraging high net worth individuals to commit. Who do you believe they are? Surely, you know, some of the big ones that are out there, are they really committed to supporting local communities?
Well, I think there is an enormous opportunity for philanthropy, and the British social system was built by the generosity of wealthy people over many centuries and the self-help principle of ordinary communities. So both at the high net worth, you know, the wealthy level, and at the ordinary level, I think we can and should factor in the opportunity of people giving directly. That's not to say we can do without a progressive tax system that takes money from the wealthy and gives it to causes and places that are less prosperous, but we can also invite people to do that themselves directly. And I would like to see the UK, well, it sort of already is in part, but I would like it to be definitively the global centre of philanthropy, where all the best thinking around real good impact philanthropy, how do you use private money well? So who are they? Well, I mean, they're you and me, Keith, and they're everybody who makes money in business, I think, should think, how are they going to support wider communities, and how do they earn personal fulfilment through that? I mean, last point to make quickly on this is, I think there's a huge opportunity in what's called diaspora philanthropy. So people who, you know, everyone comes from somewhere, but most wealthy people end up in the big cities. So we should be encouraging people to give back to the places they came from.
Just a couple of quick questions just before we finish. Camilla, do you want to just raise your question about faith?
Yes. Danny, you talk a lot about faith groups, and from what I'm hearing on the ground, faith groups have been extraordinary in their response to COVID. But the interesting thing about faith groups is they're independent of government, they run themselves, they like it that way. But you have actually talked about their, as it were, estrangement from government. You seem to want to link them more with what is going on centrally in Parliament and locally in local government. Now, how's that going to work?
Well, it's up to them. Yes, many people in faith communities don't want anything to do with the official system, and and that is tremendous. But many would like to play a greater role in meeting social challenges. And the problem they find is that commissioners and local government all take one look at them and say, you're motivated by some strange religious belief, we're not going to have anything to do with you. And our responsibility in government is to challenge that faith-phobic culture in the public sector, so that where there is a desire on the part of a faith community to play a role in public services, that should be supported and enabled. I don't think the government needs to give faith communities a lot of money. I think we have huge resources in faith communities, actually. But government does need to instruct their servants at all levels to cooperate better with the faith sector.
Alex.
Yeah, I can't finish without really asking you about measures of success. How will you define the success of your report, and within what timeline?
I was too sensible, I should say, to put into my report, you know, a set of objectives that need to be delivered by X, Y, and Z. That isn't really my, I don't think that would have been appropriate, but I am really hopeful that we'll get some of this to happen. But in answer to your question, and sorry if this isn't very precise, we need a culture change. We need the whole of government and, frankly, society and the media to think about civil society not as the sort of cleaners that come in after the mess has been made by big government and big business and sort of does a bit of tidying up, but as the central agency of our society. And I want to see the whole conversation change. That would be success for me. There's a whole bunch of policy stuff that I hope can happen in this Parliament, but really we're talking about a shift in the way we think about our society.
We've heard time and time again, Danny, in the last 12 months or so particularly, from charity leaders who say that the mood music around Whitehall is very negative towards charities, that they are feel themselves to be the lowest of the low, they're right at the end of the pecking order, and very often the door is closed in their face and they're not invited to meetings and things like that. How are you going to reassure the charity sector now that a new era is dawning?
Well, I say this as one of them, because I was a charity chief exec for many years. We love to moan about government ignoring us, but that's because it's our fault for not becoming civil servants. We want to sit outside government. We can't then complain if we're not treated as quite as insidery as parts of the public sector are. And I think that grumbling is always going to be there. But actually, I think it's a fair complaint. I think we, we now, with my Conservative Party MP hat on, I think we need to be much more alive to the potential that the voluntary sector plays, social enterprise and charities and faith groups play in our society. I think it's there, it's latent in our, I'm a Conservative, it's latent in our philosophy. You won't find a Tory MP who doesn't agree when I say we need a greater role for communities. I just think they have been understandably, and you know, going back to the beginning of our conversation, understandably focused on the big ticket items, obviously Brexit and coronavirus aside, focused on levelling up through economic redistribution and investment in the big, you know, infrastructure that our country needs. I think there's another story about society and communities which plays very well with Conservatives. There's no ideological problem. It's just about giving it the focus it needs, which I hope we'll can begin to have.
Danny, thank you so much for your time. Just one final thing, which is that, you know, you propose this idea of a Neighbour Day to bring communities together. How are you going to spend your first Neighbour Day?
Oh, I'll spend it in Devizes cheerleading for all these incredible community groups we have there and, you know, claiming the credit for everyone having a bad holiday.
Thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and we'll wait and see what happens to some of your proposals and monitor things with interest. Many thanks. So those are the thoughts of Danny Kruger MP on his own review, which has been given to Boris Johnson and is being presumably mulled over at the moment. Let's just go round the table. What are our thoughts on that one? Alex?
I want to believe his passion. I think he does genuinely believe that he has more hope of changing things from the inside than the out. I'm not sure we really got to the nub of the issue in terms of timing and money and priorities and how government's really going to get engaged. But if it's the beginning of a conversation, one can only hope that then the action's going to follow.
Camilla?
I love the phrase he used. I'm only floating that as a possibility. You could say that about any of the 20 recommendations that he makes. He's obviously not wanting to tell anybody, and certainly not any community group or charity, volunteer organization or faith group, what they should do, because that would be top down. And he's talking about leveling up. It is about values, and he says all Conservatives have them. I'm always suspicious, though. I always want to say, well, put your money where your mouth is. And I guess my last question would have been, how friendly are you with the Treasury?
Seems to me also that the backdrop to this is obviously coronavirus, and yet the immediate needs of charities during the period of coronavirus are not referred to at all. This is almost a visionary document which could have been written with or without coronavirus, and is almost pushing us forward almost 10 years on. This is what it would be really nice if this was, without really engaging with the bits that we've got to do in between. Would that be fair?
I agree. I don't think this has got really any hook that says it's driven by COVID. You know, I think the suggestions are great, but, you know, I'm still not convinced that there is going to be the money, the enthusiasm, the opportunity to deliver some of these. Having said that, you know, if he can play Robin Hood and get money out of anybody and give it to the charities, yeah, well played to him. I'm up for that.
Lots of charity organisations have already said this, but, you know, there is a certain familiarity around some of the things that are being discussed. And big society is the thing which is sort of in everybody's mind. Is this just a sequel to the big society?
Yeah. The difficulty, though, David, is he wrong, as it were, to echo that and bring it back, if what we're hearing from charity is not only government is not listening, they're actively hostile. And that is something that surely, surely needs to change.
Just Alex, one final word. I mean, is this going to have a real impact, or is this one of those reviews which is going to get buried somewhere as a nice piece of work, very interesting, we'll carry on doing what we're doing? What's your feeling about it, about the impact that it's going to have?
Well, I don't think it's going to have an impact till government is fully engaged with at least one or two of the recommendations and it sits within a timescale that is going to come immediately post-COVID. Otherwise, I think there's a risk that that momentum, that community spirit, the volunteering and all that's been gained as a positive against a dreadful backdrop of COVID could well be lost.
We shall wait and we shall watch. This has been a Good Charity, Bad Charity special edition featuring Danny Kruger, MP, the author of what we are now universally, I think, calling the Kruger Review. My thanks to Camilla and Keith and to Alex Scales. Thanks to producer Dan Hardoon. Of course, to City Bridge Trust and the Centre for Charity Effectiveness, who support our podcast. We'll be back with you again soon.